Okay, let's unpack this. Have you ever really thought about what might be hiding in, national archives, all these cultural treasures, just waiting?
Absolutely. Untold stories tucked away.
Exactly. And today we're doing a deep dive into one such collection. We're talking about the really vibrant Erzya and Moksha heritage.
All preserved in Estonian archives.
Right. It's this incredible mix of folklore, material culture, personal stories. Just a rich tapestry.
Yeah, and our main guide here is this comprehensive book, Erzya Heritage in Estonian Archives by Natalia Ermakov. It pulls from just an amazing range of sources. We're talking articles, research, field diaries, which are fascinating, personal notes, audio, photos,
Wow.
spanning over a century, actually, from 1913 right up to 2024.
So our job today really is to pull out the most important bits for you.
The key insights.
Yeah, revealing these centuries of cultural exchange, the resilience of the community, and just how crucial oral tradition is.
And we'll explore how all these materials really shine a light on the Erzya culture, their journey, the efforts to keep their identity alive. It's quite a story.
So where do we start? To really get this, we need to go back right
Right.
to the beginning.
Right back. The very first items, seven Mordovian pieces, they actually arrived at the Estonian National Museum, the ERM, way back in 1913.
1913. So what does that initial acquisition tell us?
Well, it's interesting because even before that, there was academic interest. A linguist, Ferdinand Johann Wiedemann,
Okay.
he was already collecting Erzya Mordovian grammar data from garrison servicemen in Revel, which is Tallinn now.
Okay, so the interest is there.
Yeah, but the 1913 collection, that was different. It was facilitated by Peter Savi. He managed a manor in Penza Governorate. He sent peasant artifacts, a photo.
So this is the first institutional recognition then.
Exactly. That's the key thing. It moves from just individual scholarly interest to the museum, the archive, formally acknowledging this culture. It was the start of a relationship.
A relationship that became vital, it sounds like.
Absolutely pivotal for preserving this heritage.
And it wasn't just those seven items, was it? It kept going.
No, it wasn't isolated. More collections followed pretty quickly. Voldemar Rosenstrauch sent 57 items in 1915.
57, wow.
Yeah. And Ewald Paavo sent two women's outfits. Then music researcher Armas Otto Apo Väisänen.
Oh, the famous one.
Right. He contributed jewelry, folk costumes, and these weren't just stored away. They were actually featured in an exhibition in 1928.
Really?
Yeah, with seven Mordovian mannequins showing off the clothing. So quite visible.
So we see these early sparks, these initial collections, but how did it go from that, individual donations to something more structured, like a national effort?
Well, that shift really happened in the 1960s. That's when things got more systematic.
Okay.
You had Estonian researchers. Many were students of Paul Arist.
His name comes up a lot in Estonian ethnography, doesn't it?
He basically set the standard. So his students, scholars from the ERM, they started actively gathering everything, linguistic data, folklore, ethnographic stuff.
And they worked with Mordovian institutions.
Often, yeah. Collaboration was key. It built this network, for broader preservation efforts.
That makes sense.
Huh.
Now, you mentioned field diaries earlier. Those sound fascinating.
Oh, they are. That's where it gets really personal, I think. These researchers kept detailed diaries, and they give you this unique window into what it was actually like being there.
Not just the findings, but the experience.
Exactly. Take Tia Pietamäe's diary from her 1987 expedition. It's full of these vivid little details.
Like what?
Well, she talks about the train journey, noticing the Mordovian ornamented curtains in her compartment. Then there was this whole mishap with a bus.
Oh dear.
Yeah, ended up on the wrong one, had to scramble off with all their bags. Someone apparently joked that training is good for you.
Right?
And she finally gets to this pioneer camp, and her bed is right under this huge portrait of Lenin.
No way.
Yeah, she found it kind of amusingly watchful. But her observations, they paint a real picture. Muddy roads, the landscape, and the cemeteries.
What about the cemeteries?
She noted these unique master marks on the graves.
Master marks. What are those?
They're like distinct symbols, could signify the person's clan, maybe their job or some personal trait, kind of a visual history etched there.
Fascinating.
And what really struck her, and even their local Mordovian guide, Nikolai Mokshin, was the custom of sharing meals with the deceased right there at the graveside.
Wow. That was new, even to the local guy.
Apparently so. But she also writes about the generosity of the villagers, offering porridge, Mordovian style, fresh milk.
But collecting wasn't always easy.
No, she notes that too. Sometimes they just couldn't acquire items for the museum. So these diaries, they capture the successes, the struggles, the human side of it all.
That detail about Lenin, it makes you chuckle, but it really shows the dedication, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Going through all that.
Absolutely.
Which makes you think, how important was it that Erzya people themselves were also collecting and preserving their own traditions?
Oh, incredibly important. Crucial, really. And that brings us to people like Mihai Suvorov.
Okay. Tell us about him.
He was an Erzya folklorist, lived 1909 to 1973 from Kubyshev Oblast, which is Samara now. He was actually a teacher and a chemical engineer by training. But he got ill, had to stop working, and just dedicated himself to collecting Erzya folklore. And the amazing thing is he sent his entire collection.
The whole thing.
Everything. 113 audio tapes, over 800 pieces, plus handwritten folders, another 400 pieces, sent it all to the Estonian Literary Museum.
Why Estonia?
He specifically trusted his Estonian colleagues to preserve it and use it. It says so much about those cross-border connections.
That level of trust is remarkable.
It really is. And there's even a museum and cultural center dedicated to him now in Staraya Shantala, opened in 2002.
That's wonderful. And then there's Viktor Danilov.
Yes, Viktor Danilov lived 1942 to 2002, and Erzya ethnologist and folklorist from Tatarstan. He actually moved to Estonia in 67.
Oh, so he lived here?
Yeah, studied at Tartu University, taught at the Estonian Agricultural Academy. And what's really interesting, he was one of the founders of the ensemble Hellero.
The music group.
Right. And he brought Erzya songs into their repertoire. Imagine that, a direct cultural infusion.
That's a fantastic bridge.
It really was. His collection, also digitized now, is full of valuable folklore and ethnography. And there's a very poignant story about his mother, Anastasia Romanovna.
What's that?
She lived to be almost 90. And she expressed this deep sorrow that for 12 years after Viktor died, no relatives had managed to visit his grave in Tartu.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
It is. But it highlights that deep personal connection, doesn't it? And the role of groups like the Estonian Mordovian Society in trying to maintain those links.
It shows these aren't just academic collections. They're tied to real lives, real families.
Exactly.
And the range of stuff they collected, Tuvajov and Danilov, it's huge, isn't it? Laments, songs for weddings, funerals, recruits, myths, history, kid songs, spells.
Everything, the whole spectrum of life.
What does that tell us? That sheer diversity.
It gives you this incredible reflection of their society, how they saw the world, how things changed, even how they dealt with hardship and fate. Every part of life had its expression.
So within all that, one type of expression really seems central. The lament, the itkud. Why are these so significant?
Well, Erzya laments, they're these traditional monologues, mostly performed by women, expressing grief, sorrow, longing. They were a core part of rituals. Funerals, yes, but also weddings, sending young men off to the army.
Interesting. Weddings, too.
Yeah, often expressing the sorrow of leaving one's family. And what's striking is how similar they are in some ways to Sido traditions here in Estonia.
How so?
Certain motifs pop up in both, like asking bewildered questions, why did they die? Or expressions of sorrow, like it's hard to bury. It shows these deep cultural connections, maybe.
And the language itself, it's very poetic, right?
Oh, incredibly rich. They use these powerful comparisons, like crushed me like a flower, dried me like hay. You really feel the vulnerability. And epithets like green child, meaning young and inexperienced, or hyperbole spinning like a silver ball to show overwhelming emotion. It's a real oral art form.
You can almost hear the emotion. That example, the mother's lament for son going to military service.
Yes.
It talks about her struggle to say goodbye, but also that connection. My heart will listen if it gets hard for you.
It's incredibly moving.
And that other one, the daughter's lament for her mother, performed by Tatiana Anikieva.
Right, and the context there is so raw. Her own 14-year-old daughter had died suddenly just the year before.
So performing the lament was part of processing her own grief.
It seems that way. It shows these aren't just museum pieces. They're living traditions, ways people connect with and express deep, universal human emotions, even today.
So this brings us to the community here in Estonia, the diaspora. Why did so many Mordovians come here in the first place?
Well, most arrived during the Soviet era, mainly between, say, 1959 and 1970.
What?
Often they were specialists, sent here to work after university. They tended to settle in cities.
Were there other reasons?
Sure. Family ties. Maybe they already knew people here. Marriage. The usual reasons people move.
Any examples that stand out?
Here's Boris Kabur, an inventor and translator, very proud of his Moksha roots. Or Zoja Okina and Mikhail Ijukin. They were the only Erzia couple, both Erzia in Tallinn for a long time, very active in the society.
And that story about the man who discovered his identity abroad?
Oh, right. Alexei Milivanov, born in Tallinn, but apparently discovered his Erzia identity while living in England. Just shows how complex identity can be.
Absolutely. What about language? Has it been hard to maintain?
It's definitely been a challenge. The data shows a slight dip in self-identified native speakers between 59 and 2000. Not huge, but a dip.
From about 42% down to
around 39.7%. For many, Russian became the main language, you know, and often the kids, the second generation, didn't pick up Erzia or Moshe fluently.
But there are hopeful signs.
Yes. By 2019, the source notes four families in the Estonian Mordovian society whose children did understand the language, often because of visits back to the homeland.
Ah, maintaining that connection.
Exactly. And today, you have young families, scholarship students who are speaking the language at home. There's this real value placed on bilingualism.
Why is that seen as so important?
Well, it fosters tolerance, flexibility, connects generations. And there's this feeling, this belief that their ancestral heritage, it's somehow deeper, richer, inexpressible in other languages.
That makes a lot of sense. You mentioned the society. How important have these cultural groups been?
Oh, instrumental. Absolutely key in keeping the culture alive here.
Tell us about them.
Okay, so there are three main active ones. The Estonian Mordovian Society founded in 94. That was Jüri Kolnin. Amazing story there.
What happened?
Apparently, he'd been married for 25 years, was on a train, and suddenly had this aha moment, realizing his Erzia identity. His wife was reportedly not initially thrilled.
Ugh. I can imagine.
Then you have the Erzia Moksha Society Shako from 97 and the Mordovian Cultural Society Jalgai from 2011.
And their goal is?
It's really about preserving the language, the culture, passing on those spiritual values, but also about integrating into Estonian society. It's a dual focus.
Mm-hmm. And who joins these groups? Just Mordovians?
And no, that's what's interesting. It's diverse. Mordovians, sure, but also Russians from different regions, Estonians, even Finns. It's quite inclusive.
Alongside the community efforts, there's been significant institutional support too, hasn't there?
Yes, definitely. It's not just the National Museum or the Literary Museum. The Estonian Academy of Music and Theater, for instance, they've done these sophisticated multi-channel audio recordings of polyphonic songs.
Allowing for deeper analysis.
Exactly. Really precise musical analysis. And Tallinn University supported Natalia Ermakov's PhD on the laments, and her personal connection to the community added so much depth there.
Right.
Then there's the Estonian Language Institute, EKI. They hold important linguistic archives, and crucially, they developed the first big Estonian Erzia electronic dictionary.
How big?
6,000 keywords. That's a massive tool for both communities, for language learning, revitalization.
A real bridge.
Absolutely. And Tartu University, of course, holds huge amounts of linguistic and ethnographic material, too. Generations of researchers have contributed there.
And the fact that nearly all of this is digitized now, mm-hmm. that must make a huge difference.
Oh, enormous. Accessibility is one thing, obviously, but it opens up new ways to analyze the material, especially for language research. And for the diaspora, it's a vital link back to their heritage in the digital age.
So we've covered a lot of ground, this deep dive into the Erzia and Moksha heritage in Estonia. It's really quite something.
It truly is.
A real testament to the dedication of so many people, collectors, researchers, community activists, all fighting to preserve this culture.
And if you look at the bigger picture, the Erzia story here really highlights how crucial oral tradition is, especially for cultures maybe without long written histories, and how archives, how institutions can play such a vital role in safeguarding that. It gives us these profound insights into identity, history, values.
Yeah, the knowledge itself just becomes more valuable over time.
Right, definitely. It's authentic material for researchers, for education. It keeps the culture connected to its roots.
Which leads to maybe a final thought. How does understanding this journey, the journey of one relatively small, resilient culture like the Erzia in Estonia, how does that help us understand bigger themes like identity, migration, cultural survival in our, you know, fast-changing world?
That's the question, isn't it?
Yeah. And what can we learn about the sheer power of heritage from people who are actively working, often against the odds, to keep it alive? Something to think about.
Absolutely.
We really hope this dive is giving you a new perspective, maybe spark some curiosity. If you want to explore more, you can check out resources like folklore.easiter, muijas.ea for the museum collections, ikki.edi.katursa for that dictionary,
and murderedav.ut.e for Tartu University's archives.
Plenty to explore. So dive in yourself and keep learning.